Now let's see if I can work this. I'm very glad to be back here and speaking to you again. Today I'm going to speak to you about democracy in the United States. In the United States and elsewhere in the world, democracy has come to mean electoral representative arrangements. And concretely what that is electoral representative arrangements means that most people have the right to vote. It means that most government officials have to stand for election so that the voters get to say yes or no periodically. And concretely what it means is that political parties have the rights and the resources to organize those voters. Because if every voter goes off in their own direction, they don't have influence. Only when they coalesce around specific candidates and specific programs, and the coalescing is done by political parties, do they have influence. That's sort of the democratic model. That model, those ideas, have fired the imaginations, the passions of people for hundreds of years. Because people have always believed that if they had democracy, the right to vote for the elites who had government power, who had control over law, who had control over military force, that's what government power is. If they had the right to vote for those people, they would have influence over them, and they would therefore have influence over the laws and the uses of military force in their societies. For just those reasons, democracy has always been a threat to those who have property. The essential nature of that threat was capped way back in the 17th century in England, in the English Revolution, when one of the levelers, the troops that fought the English Revolution, when one of the levelers said to a general in their army, "How can it be that we, the poor, who have fought this war, will not, as a result of this revolution, have the right to vote?" And the general replied, "If we allow the poor to have the vote, there will be no secure property." That issue has always been the issue. It was the issue for the founders of the United States, the men who gathered to write the Constitution, to create a new government, including electoral representative procedures. They were afraid of what James Madison called majority factions. There was good reason for them to be afraid. After all, the only reason they were able to create a new government independent from the English crown is because they had fought a war to free themselves from England, and it was ordinary farmers who had fought that war, who had picked up the guns and who had enlisted in the militia, and who had, in the end, defeated the Redcoats. These people had been drawn to the cause by their ideal of radical democracy, by their idea that if they freed themselves from England, the new government would be created that would be exposed to the people. The men who wrote the Constitution were not ordinary folk. They were the big landowners and bankers and exporters of the time. Yet they had to take account of the passions of the people who had fought the Revolutionary War. And they were afraid of them. They were afraid of democratic passions. And one of the ways in which they tried to fence in, resist the influence of the masses was by dividing the powers of the new national government that they were creating among several branches, so that it would be more difficult for a majority faction to capture the government. Powers would be divided between the House of Representatives and the Senate and the executive and the courts. And moreover, the courts would not be exposed to the electorate, would not be exposed to voters. Now, those arrangements, they're embedded in our Constitution, have been very significant for our political development because they help to explain why American political parties, the founders didn't want political parties, but they developed anyway, but the political parties that developed as a result of the handiwork of the founders were relatively weak and porous. What I mean by that is that they were not what political scientists call responsible parties. These parties, during campaigns, made promises, but because the power to make decisions was dispersed among different centers of government, the parties could not readily see to it that the promises they made were carried out by the candidates that ran under the party banner. So the parties were not responsible parties in the United States. Never were they responsible parties. And because the party activity clustered around different centers of governmental authority, different centers in the national government, and then there were the state governments and the local governments, the parties were very porous. You could penetrate them, and interest groups did penetrate the parties. Interest groups have influence not because they mobilize voters, but because they mobilize other resources, like money. Well, nevertheless, there were the fundamental facts of democracy. Lots of people in the United States, lots of men, lots of white men, had the right to vote from the beginning of the American Republic. And in the 19th century, as our political system developed, American elites in the political parties found ways to organize those voters without giving them influence over public policy. The United States was a kind of pioneer in the manipulation of mass electorates. We did this in two main ways. Our political parties, although they did not control the centers of decision very effectively, the centers of governmental decision very effectively, did control voters. And they controlled voters through a system that is sometimes called clientelism, or you will know about this system as the political machine. What the political machines did, the political parties were the political machines. And what they did was they used the resources of government, the wealth of government, to pay for the ward captains, the party cadres, who built loyalty among the voters, not because the parties would push a particular public policy, but because they would give favors to a particular family or a particular street or a particular community. Favors in the form of a Christmas basket, or favors in the form of helping the son of the family when they were hauled in to night court, or favors in the form of a license for the local saloon keeper. So instead of winning voters by promising to use broad governmental authority in a way that was responsive to the hopes and needs of ordinary people, we developed a system where governmental authority was split into little pieces, some of which were given away to the people who worked the wards to build allegiance. Now, that was the one way, the machine. The other way in which voters were manipulated and their allegiance was controlled in the 19th century was a way that I call tribalism. The American political parties cultivated ethnic and religious differences among the voters. Now, you would think that political parties that needed majorities to win would try to override these differences. But to the contrary, in the United States, we had a political system that accentuated the differences between ethnic groups and racial groups and religious groups, and that emphasized the symbols that would win each group, because they could be won. They weren't being won on a common platform, they were being won on disparate, divided favors. And so in, you all know this, especially those of you who are from New York City, you know the long tradition in New York City where we always had an Italian, a Jew, and a Puerto Rican on the ticket, right? And then an African American on the ticket. Our political parties organized voters with the symbols of what we should call tribal representation. Now, as long as you organized voters with personal favors and by cultivating ethnic and racial identities, voters pretty much could be manipulated, could be controlled. They would not try to have a say on the big political issues of the day, the big political issues having to do with tariffs and war and currency and westward development. And in the 19th century, for most of the 19th century, the electorate was not a problem. It was not a problem for American economic and political elites because the electorate was managed. However, the democratic idea, the idea that ordinary people should have a say over who controls the great power of government to make laws and to use military force, that democratic idea is hard to stifle, hard to repress, hard to snuff out for long. And toward the end of the 19th century, in the wake of early industrialization, the building of the railroads, there were a wave of mass strikes, the first strikes in the American experience, largely railroad strikes and iron and steel strikes. And toward the end of the 19th century, the family farmers of the United States, who were being bled dry by the big railroads and the prices they charged to take farm products to market, the family farmers started to organize. And because their problems were so severe, the hardships they confronted, both the industrial workers, the early industrial workers, and the farmers, and also because they believed in the democratic idea, this idea which has... You can't hear me? When did you stop hearing me? Okay, come on. All right, we're going to move it up so I can drop my voice and speak confidentially. All right. How's this? Okay. Because people confronting new hardships and uncertainties and instabilities believed so much in the democratic promise, in the promise that they could use their votes to control government authority, one of the ways in which the great movements of industrial workers and farmers expressed themselves in the late 19th century was through the electoral path. They formed third parties to try to influence government. And finally, at the end of the 19th century, the farmers' movement, called the populist movement, formed an alliance with the Democratic Party to try to win control of national government. The main responses of American elites, especially industrial and financial elites, to this development was to sponsor a democratic counter-revolution in the United States. That counter-revolution took several forms. One was to attack local party organizations, especially big city party organizations, the party organizations that rested on immigrant working class voters, to attack them by stripping them, in the name of reform, of the resources that they had used to mobilize those voters. It's true that those resources were machine resources, but in the shadow of the great movements of the late 19th century, there was the threat that these machine parties would also become a vehicle through which the new industrial immigrant working class would make policy demands. So these parties were weakened. Municipal reform movements stripped them of resources. Then also there were new laws in the state capitals which limited the right to vote. At the end of the 19th century, those laws included laws establishing literacy requirements as a condition for the right to vote. We had literacy requirements in New York City until 1965. Those laws included the revival of the poll tax, requiring people to pay a steep fee in order to exercise the right to vote. And those laws included a new system of personal periodic voter registration, which required that those who wanted to vote figure out how, in the months before the election, how to get themselves on the voter lists by going through the what were for many people difficult hurdles of fulfilling the voter registration requirement. These new conditions on the right to vote, this democratic counter-revolution, had the effect of driving voter turnout down rapidly in the United States. So that we went from elections in the 19th century, which had 80% turnout in presidential elections, to the characteristic pattern of the 20th century, which was evident by the 1920s, where only half the electorate turns out to vote, even in the most important presidential election. And guess what? Which half turns out? The better off half turns out. The people who were pushed out of the electorate by these new requirements, both the legal requirements and the bureaucratic requirements of voter registration. The people who were pushed out were mainly working class people, poor people, and in the South, African Americans were virtually entirely barred from the polls. Now, this change further transformed the political parties. The political parties weren't so great to begin with in the United States for reasons that have to do with our constitutional structure and for reasons which have to do with the pattern of machine-like politics and tribal politics that had developed. But once the political parties knew that working class and poor and minority people were less likely to vote, the political parties ignored them. The political parties didn't pay attention to their language, their style, their neighborhoods, or their issues. And that further depressed turnout among the people who confronted legal and administrative obstacles to vote. This facilitated a style of campaigning which first emerged in the election of 1896 in the United States, and which is very familiar to us now. It's the election campaign as a mass advertising campaign. Big money started to pour into national elections. At the beginning, The instruments of mass advertising were pamphlets and flyers. Now, of course, they're TV ads, slogans, lies that are the regular substance of our campaigns. It's impossible to overstate how important this development was. It occurred on the eve of industrialization in the United States, of mass industrialization. This was the period of time in which, in most European countries, working class men were just winning the right to vote. When they won the right to vote, fledgling socialist and labor parties acquired a constituency and became a force in national politics. Those parties then became the voice of the working class in electoral politics and succeeded in developing a series of policy protections for the working class that we call the welfare state. The reverse happened in the United States. Here a series of changes were introduced on the eve of industrialization, which meant that the votes of working, poor, and minority people mattered less because there were fewer of them. And when the votes of working, poor, and minority people mattered less, other resources mattered more. Money and economic power mattered more. And those who had money and economic power became more and more of an influence in the parties. Until today, money swamps the political parties and the campaign organizations that they give birth to. And money makes possible their ability to run elections as total advertising campaigns in an effort to delude and manipulate the electorate. Well, the result of this characteristic form of electoral politics in the United States in the 20th century was that our labor laws were less protective of labor. Our social welfare policies, unemployment insurance, social security, welfare, our health policies, our housing policies were stingier and more restrictive. And our regulation of business was timid and regularly deferential to business interests. But the contest, this contest that was from the beginning a contest between the propertied, who wanted to continue their control over governmental authority, the contest between property and democracy continues. It continues on many fronts. You know, there were victories in the 1960s to expand democracy, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. But in the wake of those victories, the Voting Rights Act, the National Voter Registration Act, which came after the 1960s, in the wake of those victories, we again saw the mobilization of political elites to restrict voting. There were so many episodes, not just in Florida. No, from very early after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, there were a series of indictments in the South, in Mississippi and in Alabama, of volunteer registrars who were trying to register African American voters. They were indicted for one procedural error or another. Or think about the way in which conservative candidates have regularly threatened minority voters. You know, Jesse Helms has won his elections by sending out postcards telling minority voters that they could be indicted on felonies if they were not legitimate registered voters. Or think of the way in which local Republican parties have hired off-duty policemen to prowl the polling places and to warn people that if there was anything irregular about their registration, they too could be indicted on felony charges. Or think about the failure in state after state to implement the intent of the National Voter Registration Act, which was to make voter registration services available to people not only at driver's license agencies, but at welfare agencies, at Medicaid agencies, at food stamp agencies. It does not happen. It is the law. It is not implemented adequately anywhere. Or think about Florida.